Thank you.
I got that.
There we are. Okay.
Good. Are we good? Those of you who are, can see, those can you see for those who want to? Yeah, okay. If not, it's a Safaria. It's a website called Safaria. Although, yeah, Safaria. It should have on top, on it should say Morasha 2 on God. Do you have it or no? No? Sorry? No, that's not right. Let me see.
It worked for you? You need to put it in to, I don't know. You need to do this in in Safari, not in Google.
Safari. So
put it up here, or in your web browser. You need to type it in.
Okay.
All right.
There you go.
Okay. Hopefully we have pages. Okay, so the pages that I sent everyone, or the text that I had sent out to everyone to read for this month, is on God. It's a presentation by Maimonides, by the Rambam. It opens his book. Now, he wrote three major books. The Rambam wrote first in his life a commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah is essentially a distillation of Jewish law that essentially runs through all 613 mitzvot of the Torah and presents the developments, their explanations, the rabbinic assertions and establishments on those laws. We have the Mesorah. It is our tradition that it was, for all intents and purposes, compiled by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi some 2,000 years ago. Maimonides wrote a commentary on that work. He did that from the age of 24 to 30. And he writes that he did this at the end of the book. He writes that he did this as he was running essentially for his life, because he was not able to stay in Spain because the Almohads had taken over and there was a great deal of violence going on. So he had to leave Spain at the age of 20. Broke his heart to leave Spain. He loved Spain very much, and he traveled all over the place in order to be able to find refuge with his family. It's a very long story. In the end, he finds himself in Egypt, and he ends up living the rest of his life in Egypt. And it took him 10, so he writes this commentary on the Mishnah. It's his first work, and at the end of it, he says that I wrote this on the run, basically. So if there are any mistakes in it, you should judge me favorably. I wrote this from memory and in my mind on ships, on camels, and so this is what it is. I think it's good. But if there's anything that you feel is missing, please let me know. Write to me. I will love to hear. It's the most important thing for me is to know that it's accurate rather than it's, that I'm right. He then writes his magnum opus, which is the Mishneh Torah, which literally means a review of Torah. He borrows this term from the book of Deuteronomy. We refer to the book of Deuteronomy, the Hachamim refer to the book of Deuteronomy as Mishneh Torah, as the review of Torah, because essentially it's Moses' treatment of Torah from his perspective. It's part of Torah. It is given over with prophecy like all the other four books of the Torah, but it is very much Moshe's book. So Rambam, Maimonides, when he writes his magnum opus, in which he treats the entirety of the 613 mitzvot, the rabbinic developments and the customs that came from them up until his days, and codifies it in 14 books, he calls this Mishneh Torah. He says, this is a review of Torah, what I've done for you over here. And he goes so far as to say, what you need to do in order to be able to know the entire Torah, practically what to do and what it says to you, is read the five books of the Torah
and my book. Or literally says read scripture, so it could include all 24 books of the Tanakh, and my book. You don't need anything in between. And once you've done that, you have everything. So he was extremely confident, Maimonides. His final book that he writes is not meant for the masses. He does not write this for most people. He says this at the beginning of the book. The Mishneh Torah was written for everyone. The Moreh Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, was not written for everybody. He says, this I write for one person. And the truth of the matter is, he wrote it for one person. He had one student that he loved with all of his heart and that he cherished and felt that he was a thinker in a mind that he was not used to finding. And he writes this correspondence, essentially, to his student as a response and as guidance to his student that he felt was essential in order for him to really understand the depths of Torah. And he calls this the Moreh Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. And he writes at the beginning, he says, I know that people are going to read this. It will be published. He intends that it should be published. But he says, if only one person can understand it, that's enough for me. I don't need it to be understood by everybody. Now, what I sent out to you is the opening five paragraphs of the Mishneh Torah, that second work that I told you about, the work that essentially presents the laws of the Torah, all 613 laws, and their developments. He chooses, Maimonides chooses, to open his book discussing God. His first section of the book he calls Yesodei HaTorah, which literally means the foundations of Torah. And so Maimonides sees the ideas that he puts out in these opening chapters as the fundamental ideas of Torah. They are what the Torah is built on. And the major foundation, the fundamental core upon which everything is built, is God. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. And that is what I sent out to you for this month. Because I, as the rabbi, in this particular role that I play, would be remiss if I were to go on and talk about fundamentals of Judaism without addressing God. We just can't do it. It's not a faithful thing to do. Now, one may think, well, you know, you talk about God, you could talk about God from now until, you know, we have our last breath. He's infinite. How are you supposed to hold God in your hands and between your ears and so on and so forth? Yes, we know all of that. That's not the issue over here. The question is, I, as a human being who has a meat brain, who has to be able to think in the human terms that I think, in what capacity do I relate to God? Now, there are many ways that we can relate to God. There are many things that we can say about God. And indeed, you can bet and rest assured that many, many things have been said about God. We're not going to get into all of that. I'm simply going to present to you tonight, with the voice and writing of Rambam, of Maimonides, how we essentially see God in the most simple terms. Now, when I say the most simple terms, it's kind of a paradox, because you recognize that God is infinite, omnipotent, omniscient, is all, capital A, and yet he is the most simple being. Because if we say that he's one, it means that he's not made of parts. There are no components to God. There's no pieces to him. There are no aspects to him. There are no elements of him. There is no such thing. If we talk about those things, we only speak about those things from our perspective because we have no idea what one really is. There is no such thing as a one in our world. We have no idea of what a one would be because everything that we know that we call one, of course, can be reduced to smaller ones and those smaller ones and those smaller ones and those smaller ones. So there's nothing that we really know that is genuinely, purely, absolutely one, except for God. But we're not even going to talk about the one part yet. We're going to go to the way that the Rambam opens this. And I believe that the Rambam opens this it's an ingenious way to present it in its simplicity and in its value. The first thing that the Rambam does, and I'm sorry, I don't have the text that I sent you. I hope that you read it and that you, if not, have brought it with you. And if not, you know, I apologize for that. Maybe it's my professional flaw. But the Rambam opens up saying, Yesod ha-yesodot ve'amud ha-chokhmot leda sheyesh sham matsui rishon. The foundation of all foundations. It is at the core of all things. The pillar of all wisdom is to know, he says. He uses this word, leda, to know. Sheyesh sham, literally, that there is. Yesh is. Sham, there. So like in English, there is. Matsui Rishon, primal being. First existence. Notice that he does not say God. He will not open the discussion using that word. He does not mention God until the fifth halakha. He simply refers back to Hamatsui Hazeh or Hamitziut Hazeh. This being, this existence that I've talked to you about or that I'm referring to you or I'm referring to is this and is that and must be this and must be that. And then, if you take a look, I believe it's in the fifth paragraph, he says, oh, by the way, Hamatsui Hazeh, Hu Eloah Ha'olam. By the way, this existence that I've been speaking to you about in the last four paragraphs, he's God. Why does he do this? Before we get into what is primal existence, what is there is, why does he go into out of saying that? First thing is, I think it's important to recognize, why doesn't he mention God? I mean, we realize, obviously, that he's talking about God. I mean, he refers to him in exalted terms before he even speaks and says he is God. But he comes about it in such a roundabout way. He doesn't come until the middle. He says, oh, by the way, this existence that we're talking about, that's God. He won't say, listen, I want to talk to you about God. Why not? I'm suggesting that the reason he doesn't do that is because the minute that we say God, you already have an idea of what that means to you. I mean, you have to. It's a word that you know, and so you must have some definition for it in your mind. Maybe it's not a clear, articulate definition, but there's something that you think when you think God. It may be a man in the sky with a long beard. It may be a cloud. It may be, I mean, when I used to teach this to kids, I would teach this to my eighth grade class in New York. So we're talking about 13-year-olds, more or less. And I would ask them, when you say God, or when you think God, what do you think? I got all kinds of things. They were honest. You know, when I think God, this is what I think. So I got cloud, I got air, I got a man with a beard, I got wings, I got all kinds of things, right? I'm not going to put you on the spot. But you think, when you think God, what comes up? Rambam knows that this is what's going to happen, and therefore he doesn't say the word. He presents the definition first, and then says, by the way, this whole thing that we've been talking about, that's God. So take whatever it is that you thought, unless it's identical to what I just said, and put it on the side. Now let's follow the discussion. Okay, so that's what the Rambam does. Well, let's see what he says. He says that the foundation of all foundations is to know primal existence, the first entity. Now, he's assuming here that there is a first entity. And that's what we're assuming. That is our axiom. That is our postulate, right? That's what we're basing our ideas on. We are saying that if I were to go back, theoretically, not that I could actually get there, if I were to go back and say, what was is first, that is the entity that I would like to discuss now. That entity is what I will call God. So when I say G-O-D, the definition of that, the first entity. What the Rambam then goes ahead and does is say, well, let's think about what the implications would be of such an entity. If that entity is genuinely first, then it must be outside of time and space. He doesn't say those in so many words as I am. He says it, and we'll see it. But it's clear that essentially, if I'm talking about first entity, it would have to be outside of time and space, because time is not first, and space is not first. And so, if it were first, which it isn't, we know that it isn't, but if it were, then that's what I would be talking about when I talk about God. I wouldn't talk about God in time, I would talk about time as God, or space as God. Whatever it is that's first is what I would say or refer to when I say God. Therefore, it would make absolutely no sense to ask the question, where did it come from? Because where and from and come implies both space and time. And you can't talk about space and time when you're talking about first entity. The first entity is first. And therefore, there is no from, there is no where, there is no coming, there's none of that. None of that. That's already hitting the edges of our capacity to think. Because we can think about many things. I mean, really deep stuff. But once it goes out of the three-dimensional world and the physical universe, we just can't. We can theorize. We can speak and borrow terms all day and all night, which we will have to do. There's no way not to do it. We've got to do it. But we can theoretically at least recognize and understand, if I'm talking about first entity, Matsui Rishon, then I must talk about an entity that is not within space or time. Whatever that means. I don't have to understand what it means and how it manifests. I just know that it can't be within that. I also know that there can't be two firsts. By definition, you can't have two firsts. You could have a first and a second, but you can't have two firsts. I also know that it cannot be, and this is the key, and this is really the second thing that the Rambam says. He goes straight into this one. He says, if it is first, by definition, it cannot rely on anything else for its existence. In other words, it cannot be contingent on anything by definition, because it's first. If it were contingent on anything, then that thing that it was contingent on would then be first, and then that would be what I mean when I say God. So when I say primal existence, I am by definition saying that it is a necessary being. Necessary being, meaning it is not contingent. It relies on nothing for its existence. Everybody with me so far? Good, nods. Okay, very good. Very good. Should we open another door in here? Or is it just me talking about God that's getting me very warmed up? You all right? Yeah? It's a little warm, no? It's hot. Okay. Rav David, could you open that door? Yeah? He was one of my eighth graders, by the way. So let's take a look at how the Rambam says. He says, "In yale al hadat," which is another way of saying theoretically speaking. The literal translation of that, if it were to enter the thought that shehu eno matsui, that this primal existence didn't exist. If we're going to theoretically say there was no primal existence, nothing would exist. Now, I jumped here, he jumped here. Let's pick that apart, shall we? Says who? Well, if we are saying that primal existence is not contingent, but necessary by very way of it being first, then we are not speaking about something that exists. We are talking about existence itself, if we could say such a thing. The very force of being itself, what existence is. Now, already you can feel that I'm borrowing terms, because how are you supposed to define that thing? When I say exist, what do I mean existence it is itself? Well, that's what I'm talking about. The force of being, not the force of life, interestingly. Because when we think of being, we think of life. I'm talking about existence. The way that this exists, podium exists, it exists because existence is reality. So if I'm to go back to the first entity, that entity is not contingent. It doesn't rely on anything for its existence. Therefore, all it can be is being itself, the very force of existence itself. Anything beyond that relies on it for its being, because by definition, it isn't existence itself. And therefore, all it can be is contingent on existence. Now, however many degrees you move away from existence itself, that's fine, or however many, you know, levels of existence we may rely on is also fine. We rely on far too many things to work in order for them to even count them in order for us to be. I'm not just talking about food and air. I'm talking about ourselves, you know, just being able to maintain their intact functions and so on and so forth. You know, the mitochondria shouldn't fall apart. In one of them, you know, we just want to make sure that it all works right. And so we recognize that when the Rambam says, "Im ya'aleh al hadat shehu eino matsui," if it were to come into our mind, or if we were to theoretically say that existence itself or primal existence was not, nothing would be, because existence wouldn't be. And that's the question of why is there something rather than nothing. The interesting thing is that we don't call that primal existence something. We call it nothing. I don't mean to twist your brains around too much for an evening. We call it ayin. It exists so much it doesn't exist. Meaning, I can't really talk about it as existing, because everything that I know that exists because it relies on something, depends on something, depends on the whole slew of things in order for its existence to be. But that thing, I don't even know what that is. None of us do. And the truth of the matter is, as King David put it in Psalms, if we were to be truly accurate in our discussions of God, Lecha dumia tehila, he says, to you the only praise is silence. Anything that I say is going to detract. There's a beautiful story in the Talmud about this. It says that somebody went up to lead prayers. And you know, remember, this is the days when we didn't have a siddur, you know, no daily and occasional, none of that, right? It was all, you know, you were on the fly. You had a basic template, you knew basically what you're supposed to say, and you know, you went for it. So we have in our Amidah, we say Ha'el, Hagadol, Hagibor, Ve'hanora. We borrow that from Moses, because that's what he said. This guy decided to really go for it. And he starts adding every kind of great adjective that he could think of. And finally, the rabbis get up and silence him. They say, so when are you done? Like, at what point do you finish praising God? Whatever you're going to say is always going to sell him short, no matter what. So we do it for our purposes. We'll rely on Moses. He used those things, so we'll use those things. And, you know, at least we've got, you know, big shoulders to lean our things on. But otherwise, we've got an issue. And we realize that no matter what it is that we say about God, it's always going to be a borrowed term. Which means I am borrowing words that don't belong, but nonetheless are useful for a time and a working definition so that I can have some kind of relationship to it. So he says, if you were to think that this thing wouldn't exist, nothing would exist. However, if you were to think that everything else would disappear and wouldn't exist, he would still exist. Why? He's not contingent. It relies on absolutely nothing. When I say he, am I borrowing a term? Of course I am. There's no maleness or femaleness with this thing. So I use that term. You can argue with it, but whatever the case may be, I use it for my vernacular so that I can refer to it. And that's all. Now, he ends saying, "Shekol nimsayim tzrichim lo." Everything that exists needs him. Needs him in what way? A needy way? Not an emotional, needy way. Needs him because we're just talking about existential logistics over here. I mean, you cannot be without being. So then he says, what that means is that if we're talking about
existential truth here, which is as, you know, this is as hardcore as you get when you talk about existential truth. Existential simply meaning what exists, right? Sounds like a very expensive word. It's not a very expensive word. Existential, the manner of, or coming from, having to do with existence. So what I'm talking about over here is existential reality. When I discuss true or false, what I am referring to is what is or what isn't. I'm always discussing existential realities whenever I talk about true or false. I may talk about them in local terms, I may talk about them in cosmic terms, I may talk about them in specific terms, broad terms, whatever the case may be, but I'm always talking about them in some existential way when I'm dealing with the question of true or false. Is it real or isn't it? And if it is, in what capacity? And if it isn't, in what capacity? If I'm dealing temporally, in other words, if I'm dealing with the question of true or false embedded in time, I will talk about viability or the lack thereof. Will it end up existing if I give it its run, or won't it? So I will talk about viability, I will talk about truth, I will talk about falsehood, I will talk in these terms when I want to refer to existential questions. When I refer to God in this capacity, I'm always referring to an existential issue. And therefore, he says, Lefichach, en amitato ke'amitat echad mehen. His truth, or the truth of it, this primal existence that we're talking about, is unlike any truth at all, because it is the only thing that we can say exists emphatically. It is the very nature of truth itself. Everything else that exists has its truth based on the validity and truth of that entity. Therefore, when we refer to God as truth, we're not talking about in some philosophical terms, some theoretical terms. We're talking about in terms of existence. Now, I cannot stress enough how important it is to recognize that when we say God, that this is what we're talking about. Because when we do understand that, on whatever level we understand, we immediately recognize that we are pulling everything out. And I have to be very careful when I say this because it can be very easily misconstrued. I'm going to do my best to explain what I mean when I say this. We pull everything out of religious construct. And what I mean by that is not that it's bad to have religious constructs. Not that there's an issue with religion per se. But what the Rambam is saying over here is that at the end of the day, everything is an existential question. And our morality, meaning our good and evil sense, is connected to our true and false sense. Meaning, what I will deem as good and what I will deem as evil will have tethering, will connect back to what I recognize to be true and false, or viable, not viable. And so what I am dealing with when I talk about God is the question of existence, my being, my viability, the viability of my actions, the viability of my life, the viability and functionality in existential terms of me, my life, the world, and all that we are involved. When that is embedded in religion, the morality, behaviors, elements of religion must somehow connect to those ideas. What I will say here is, because this may be happening in your mind, right? There are elements of reality that we do not measure, that we do not necessarily see, feel, touch with our physical senses, but that we nonetheless experience
as being elements of reality, that the minute similar to God, that we start to give definitions to them, we break them down to what they genuinely are. The example I always like to give for this is love. It's one of those tough ones. I mean, how do you define it? You could write a book on it, right? You write 10 books on it. There have been many books, poems, songs, ideas, artwork, and so on and so forth, expressing love in its various capacities. And we can all agree, I would imagine, that not one encompasses its entirety. I could show you, not I, but I'm sure someone could show you, the chemical functions of one's brain and body and all of the biological mechanisms that run when one is in love. And I could present it to you, and you could see it, but you wouldn't know it. I could show you two people that love, and you could experience that, watch that, see that, but you wouldn't know it. Unless you experienced it. How do you measure it? How do you define it? How do you hold it and clarify it? For that matter, how do you do that to a thought? I mean, how do you do it? You can definitely reduce a thought to the neurons that are firing. You can reduce love to oxytocin. But not really. Because we all know that there's much more to it than those components, the constituent parts that ultimately make up its entirety. That is beyond simply what we can measure, define, feel, touch, taste in our physical reality and in our rational, reasonable discussion and thought. There are elements in reality that reason simply does not function to be able to fully explain. Now, that is not to say that we should throw reason out the window. Reason is a wonderful scaffolding, a wonderful, Don't call it words. It is kindling for the spirit. It allows for us to jump off and reach things. Without reason, we have no footing. Without rational ideas, we have no footing. But it isn't everything. So when the Rambam says, and I'm going to deal with this particular idea at the opening of my weekly classes in Hendon, I'm just telling you, that's where I'm going to deal with it, and it's not going to be tonight. When the Rambam says you must know, he is not saying through logical development or assertion. He is not saying through philosophical proof. He is saying through experiential connection, to know existence. The way that we know existence is by our own. If you exist, then existence is reality, and there must have been a first thing, and that first thing is what we call God. And that first thing must be necessary by definition. If you doubt your existence, well, then we really don't have much to talk about. No, but that's the truth. If one doubts one's own existence, then one doubts existence as a whole. And therefore, one can't really speak about existence because it's not a given. So really, it all comes down to the question of, do I know existence from my own being? If I know existence from my own being, then I know primal being. And that is the only way that we ever know God. And then once I open myself to that, I can connect. I can experience a world, my life, and everything around me as expressions of being. And that everything that we experience, all of it, has that entity that powers it. So look at the language of the Rambam over here. It's there is no English equivalent. Back up at number one in the first paragraph, right after he says that one must know primal existence, he says, "Hu mamtzi kol nimtza." He's using the root again, matza, mem tzadi aleph, which is existence. So it's saying this primal existence, mamtzi kol nimtza. Mamtzi, there is no English word for. Mamtzi means he exists as a verb. Two other things, transitive. Causes to exist, all that exists. But it's not causes to exist because that implies that there is cause and effect in a temporal way. What he's saying is it is the very cause or the capacity for anything that exists to exist. He maintains it all, always. So there's no real word for the act of existing something else, if you could say such a thing, right? Lifting something else, lowering something else, existing something else. You don't do that. Only he does that. He's the only one that does it. Therefore, there's no real word for it because we don't talk about it in any other terms, except in Lashon HaKodesh. There's a word for it. So the translators always hit a glitch whenever they have to do this because they're always bending the translation somehow. He maintains all existence, causes all things to exist. But this is a current, present tense verb. Humamtzi kol nimtza. He exists, all that exists. If I were to say that in verb form, I know it's not the way that it's supposed to sound, but you get what I'm saying. So it's not even causes to. It is current. It's what allows for all things to be. And if he were to withhold that, it wouldn't just die. You wouldn't just have a carcass. It just wouldn't be. Because remember, the carcass requires certain things in order that the carcass should form. It needs for its atoms to function properly. Yeah, how are we doing? How many people are still on board? Yeah? No, all right, good. Okay. It's a British audience. It's okay. You're not going to tell me if you're on. All right. Sorry? It's the quantum physics is the greatest development to come along for this argument, for this entire presentation. Because when I realize that everything, for all intents and purposes, is made of the same stuff, and it literally is reduced to, I mean, it depends how low you want to go, right? How deep you want to get. But if we're going to deal with our what we can manage, you know, I by no means have any place or authority of any kind to speak about quantum physics. But I remember protons, neutrons, and electrons. And if you remember the periodic table, I don't mean to make you uncomfortable, but if you remember the periodic table, right, what you know and remember at least from that is that all it does is show us that the different configurations and additions and subtractions and so on and so forth of those particles, of protons, neutrons, and electrons, is what allows for all of the elements in our world to manifest. It's just a matter of their configuration. So I'm essentially reducing things to simple building blocks. And from the configuration of those building blocks, everything is. So if I were to theoretically break things down to where they cannot break down anymore, I hit whatever being actually is. It's the greatest possible development. Nobody knew how to talk about any of this before quantum physics. Nobody knew what the heck to say. You know what they used to talk about? Earth, wind, and fire. That's what they used to talk about. Rambam talks about it. Nobody knew how to break things. Nobody had any idea how anything happened. I mean, it must be that there's earth, wind, you know, fire, and water. Great. Okay. Well, somehow, you know, there's essences of these things, all kind of platonic crazy things. And we'll put them together in all kinds of configurations. Yeah, they had the idea. It was still four. And, you know, we had these things that worked out. But to be able to tell somebody that the sun is made of the same stuff water is? What do you mean? And hydrogen. It's just what you put together with a hydrogen. You know, you turn sun into water. Because the sun's basically just a big hydrogen bomb. Okay, you know, add a couple of oxygen, you know, two hydrogens with an oxygen here. You're good to go.
So this is because Rambam was a scientist.
It's because Rambam was a thinker. Okay. He was a doctor, scientist, whatever you say. So what? Thank God. You know, otherwise we'd be in big trouble. And which is why everybody criticizes me that I don't like to bring too many other people in the Rambam. And it's true. I could branch out a little bit. And I will. I'm going to branch out a little bit because people think that I haven't read anything except the Rambam. That's not true. I've read. What I'm saying is that I find no one that is as broad, as comprehensive, as systematic, as consistent, as deep, and as thorough as the Rambam. I have yet to find anyone. So that's why I use him. Yeah?
What would you say if you just change one word in paragraph 1 and change Tamatz to Matzi to Bore? Now, what would be lost if you did that?
A massive, massive, massive loss. We would all of a sudden get back into Platonic ideas, Aristotelian ideas, and talk about, you know, primal mover. Okay, so he created. Good. So he made things. It tells me nothing about the nature of the existence of things. Not to mention the fact that it tells me nothing about the nature of the things that he creates itself. So, for example, I could talk about God as creator. He could be a utilitarian creator. Take these chairs, right? These chairs, yeah? You look at these chairs. You know who made these chairs? That's not a trick question. Nobody knows who made these chairs, except maybe whoever bought these chairs, right? And he probably doesn't even know who made these chairs anymore. You don't look at these chairs and say, I know where these came from. They're utilitarian. They do not express in any way the maker. I should not assume for any reason that if I talk about God as creator alone, that the creation should express in any way the maker. I could look at the world as utilitarian. And for all intents and purposes, we actually did think that way about the world and God for a very long time. We thought that the world was a stage for God to act in, that we were kind of part of the play, but that I couldn't necessarily recognize anything about God from the actual universe itself. What I did was I looked at how God acted in the world. Did he feed the birds? Yeah, so I should try and feed people. That's what I looked at. But I didn't look at the curvature of space and say, okay, I can understand something about the nature of God in existence. When I look at the world not as utilitarian creations, but as expressions and maintenances of existence itself, they tell me about the nature of existence itself. And so there's a very big difference between saying God made and God emanates existence in the present tense. Because I'm always looking at existence as an expression of that original entity. You say what?
No, I'm just saying, because it's the word that Torah uses, Borah.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I know.
Bereshit Bara Elohim.
So it's just interesting that I'm still trying to define what exactly Mamsi implies, but is not implied in Korean.
I just told you.
What, I still quite get it.
What do you not get?
I think you're saying there's the ongoing relationship between primal existence and...
It's not just the ongoing relationship. It is the existential connection. If that's what you mean by ongoing relationship, then yes. What I mean by existential connection is it is the very nature of the being and the expressions of being. The maintenance of being is because of capital B being itself, connection, integration, facilitation, and so on for it. Bri'ah does not imply that. Quite the contrary, as a matter of fact. Bri'ah simply implies, I'm not going to get into what Bri'ah means right now, but it is not bara that tells me this. And the interesting thing is, and I'll prove it to you, that it has nothing to do with Bereshit bara, what we're reading now. It has absolutely nothing to do with creation. You know what it has to do with? The nature of God himself. Where does the Torah command that I'm supposed to know this? Take a look. Oh, you don't have it, or may have it. In the sixth paragraph, he says, Yidi'at davar zeh, the knowledge of this thing or this idea, mitzvat aseh, it's a positive commandment, for it says in the Torah, not Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz, but I am the Lord your God. Anuchi Adonai Lech. I am God. Now, remember, when we say God, what we mean is primal existence. We say, well, that's very nice. That's a nice definition. How do you know that that's the definition? Because the word that is used for God in Torah is a word that expresses being itself. And that word is Yod, He, Vav, and He. You know the one I'm talking about, right? We don't have any God posters up in here, so you know, you'll have to imagine. We're S&P, we don't do God posters. If you think about with a little Hebrew or much Hebrew or whatever level of Hebrew that you might have, we say to be in Hebrew, lihiyot. The word lihiyot, to be, comes from the root hava, he, vav, he. Was, haya. Will be, yihye, yud, he, yud, he. Is, hove, he, vav, he. Haya, he, yud, he. You see what I'm getting at over here? The name of God is Yud, He, Vav. It is a name that expresses existence. When I talk about God, I am talking about capital E, existence, primal being, that which was before all things, which is by definition one and by definition necessary, not contingent. And therefore, when I talk about that entity, I am always talking about existence itself with a capital E. So when I say to you, as a Kohen, Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, may God bless you and keep you, what I am essentially saying to you is, may existence bless you and keep you. I am blessing you not only to be blessed by existence itself, but protected by existence itself. What more could one want? How much higher do you go? What is beyond that? And what people do not recognize and understand is that when we say God, because we mean that, there's nothing more that a person could want. Think about it. What do you like in this world? Cake? What do you like? Love? Roller coasters? Puppies? What do you like? Whatever it is that you do like, in some way, shape, or form, sometimes in a very dark and sinister, illusory way, makes you feel more alive. It's why you like it. It fills something in you that makes you feel that you have been nourished with a need, that you feel somewhat empty without. And that's even the fun things. It imbues you with the excitement, vivacity, enjoyment, what have you, of life. Yeah? Ice cold ice cream on a hot day, hot chocolate with marshmallows on a cold day, whatever you want. It fills you and it makes you feel more alive. Even drugs and whatever kind of dark things that we use, narcotics, addictions, whatever you want, those things go off the tracks, but they are used in order to fill a void, to help me feel and fill something that I am missing, that I will go to almost in circular fashion so that I should be able to have some connection to life. Something. So if I can tell you, listen, connect to God, because in God is life, and not sound like a Catholic priest. What I'm essentially saying is, listen, connect to existence. Do what's viable, what's nourishing, what is wholesome. But always know, always, and here's the key, always, always test it to make sure that it isn't killing you. Because the goal here is to live, not just to exist, but to be enlivened. There's a difference between a heart beating and a pulse and living an enlivened life. That's why when we experience things that enliven us, that we don't need, but we enjoy, and that make us happy, we have a bracha for this. Shehechiyanu. We talk to God and say, you enlivened me. V'kiyamanu, and you kept me, held me up. V'higiyanu, you brought me to this time For what? I got a new shirt. It's just, I don't know, but I mean, this is worth saying a bracha for. It's obsessive, it's insanity. Except that we understand that it's not insanity, that when you ask a Jew, what is the greatest thing that you can say? What's your biggest cheer, l'chaim? It's not cheers. Okay, are we on board? Yeah.
So it's in the existential question of that, what is that the right thing to do? Why not have an idol that brings it personal, that brings it and skips out the need to have the existential question? Why doesn't God then get presented, not have to deal with the troubles? What is this intangible star? Have an idol, and you're done.
It's relatively simple. The idol is a contingent entity. And so if you're going to start focusing all of your hopes and desires on a contingent entity, then you might as well pray to your toilet bowl. No, I'm not kidding. I'm serious. I don't mean to say that for shock value. I'm saying that in all truth and reality. There's no difference between an idol, the stars, the sun, the moon, the, you know, whatever have you, whatever it is that's the idol. If one focuses on that as primal existence or deity, then you are essentially praying to nothing different than your toenail. There's absolutely no difference whatsoever on an existential level.
That's your hook.
No. Oh, so it's different. If you want to talk about hooks, then you've got to be really careful about hooks, because we tend to focus on the hooks and not what they bring us to. We've done that for all of human history. We always miss the end. We always miss the end and love the means as though they're the end. Always. We forget, and that's not just with God. That's with everything. It's, you know, they have this situation in organizations called founder syndrome. You know what this is? Founder syndrome? Founder syndrome is when you have a founder of an organization, whatever it may be. You know, business, you know, whatever. And the business develops and gets to a point where it's quite efficient and functional. And the founder doesn't let go, because the founder keeps thinking that he or she needs to be in this thing in order for this thing to function. And what happens is that they forget why they started the thing in the first place. And the fact that they wanted it to actually function as something, and they forget that it's not about them, it's about the thing. And that happens all the time. I mean, just one example, but it really does happen all the time. In all of our lives. Why do we have kids? I mean, why do we go to synagogue? Why do we build this place in the first place? I mean, that's really one of the major things that leadership needs to be able to present. Not what are we doing, but why are we doing it? And if you can't figure out why you're doing it, then you're okay. I mean, you know, you could worship everything that's there in terms of the what, but if you don't know the why, then it's all over, which is why the Rambam opens with this. You must know this. If you don't know this, it doesn't matter what the underpinnings are. You can throw it all out. Everything's built on that. It's the Yesod HaYesodot. It's the foundation of all foundations. And that is why I'm not going to get into that. Yeah.
If that's so, and given that Torah doesn't always work, if you accept that as the primal being, why do you need the second world happening?
Why do I need?
Why do you need a second commandment having no other gods before it? Because by definition, what you say, then the second commandment becomes completely irrelevant.
That's a wonderful question. Because I was not going to mention it, but because of the question, I'll mention it. Right? Because if I recognize God as primal existence, and all that exists only exists because it exists, then I very quickly and easily can run into seeing the expressions of existence as God stuff. And I very easily can then look at it, or as you know, as James was saying, maybe the hook, right? But it's more than hook, because what I'll be looking at in terms of an expression of existence is essentially existence. There are no real differentiations. I mean, it's all one, isn't it? It all comes from one. Everything is one. And at the end of the day, we're all one. And since we're all one, really, what's the difference? Whether I worship the chair or the idea, whatever it is. I mean, whatever it is only here because God's here. And what the Torah is saying is that, no. That's not okay.
You cannot worship the expressions of existence as though they are existence. That's all it's doing, right? So yes, I am existence. Easily I run into thinking, okay, wonderful. So then everything is all part of this one, and therefore, no, no. Yeah.
What about Manichaeans? I mean, because you can have existence, you can have not existence.
Correct.
So if you can have a one, you can have a negative one.
Yeah.
So what does Rambam have to say about the possibility of there being other forces which are the opposite of existence?
Anti-gods?
Yes, anti-gods.
He doesn't speak about that. Because if I'm talking about existence and whatever it is as an expression of that entity, that's all I've got. Whatever those anti-gods are, if they are, which they aren't because they aren't, right? I mean, you know, it's an oxymoron. They don't manifest in terms of a world that is created with existence or through existence or from existence. It's completely out of the realm of discussion for any kind of reality because we are existing in an existence that is and therefore must come from isness, not notsness.
But if you posit...
Right, I'm afraid I'm going to lose the whole train.
Okay.
But go ahead.
But if you posit something that is, then the one thing you can also posit is that something that is, that is not.
Yes, what I will say to you is this. Remember that when we're talking about this existence, we will always fill it or think of it as a contingent entity. Because we don't know anything that, just let me finish. We as human beings, we don't know anything that isn't contingent. And therefore, we already strain when we recognize the Hachamim or even elements in the Torah, which I can point out, call it ayin. They call it isn't, right? Or a matter of fact, we'll talk about ex nihilo, right? Creating ex nihilo. What's the nihilo? God. Right? I mean, that's what we're referring to. I mean, while he's talking, I mean, he is, right? I'm sorry, I'm saying you created something from nothing. What's the nothing? He's the nothing. So once we're starting to talk about that entity, we are talking about a level of existence that I really cannot talk about. Right? So anytime I'm talking about a negative, I'm only talking about a negative within an existential reality that I know, that is part of my world. Once I move out of that, then I'm not really talking about anything that I know exists. I'm borrowing the term. I'm going to leave it there. Okay? Okay. I want to have a look at some of these sources that I brought for you. Let's look at number one. Pretty much everything that I brought to you in these sources comes from the Moreh, not the Mishneh Torah. Comes from the Moreh Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. It's in here where Rambam really rolls his sleeves up and actually gets into the implications of these first lines that he writes in the Mishneh Torah. And I want to look at some of these implications with you. And I'll tell you why. First of all, I mean, people might think, uh-oh, he's teaching the Moreh Nebuchim, right? Rambam wrote this for one guy. First of all, I will say that writing this 850 years ago and reading it in our day is not the same. We have to understand that the world moved through such massive developments in terms of the scientific revolution, in terms of the understandings of physics and so on and so forth, that what the Rambam used to see as esoteric, we no longer see. You know, our reception kids don't see the stuff as esoteric anymore. We've moved on as a world. So the stuff that he really couldn't talk about to many people, we kind of have as basic knowledge, all right? So this is what he does. He says, look, I want to talk to you about the name of God. Not the name, the names of God. We have a whole bunch of names for God. We use all different kinds of names. He says, I want you to understand that kol shmotav yit'aleh ha-metzuyim b'sfarim kulam nigzarim min ha-peulot. Wherever you see names of God, in all of the books, in the Bible, in the Talmud, wherever you see it, what you are seeing is, in the expression of that name, some element of action that we perceive that comes from God. And therefore, we attribute it to God. So if we're calling him, for example, Adonai, what I'm talking about is a master. Adon. Adon is a master, right? Adon HaKol, the master of all. That is a peula. It is an action, so to speak. It's an active element of God. So I'm borrowing that and attributing it to God. Yeah. If I say Elohim, Lord, which is literally what the word means. Yeah. I mean, in this country, we definitely know what that word means. You've got Lord Sachs, you've got Lord, you know, a whole bunch of people that are lords, right? They're all Elohim, all of them. And you have a whole house of Elohim. You have a Beit Elohim, it's a house of lords. That's what the word means. We refer to God as Elohim. He's the ultimate Lord. But he's a Lord. It's a pe'ula. It is an action. It's a role. Yes? All of the names of God have that in common. We perceive something as coming from God, as having to do with God. We call him that name. Zema she'en bonela, right? I mean, these are things that aren't concealed to us. It's what we experience. Zulati, except for one name. That name, Yod He Vav He. Yod He Vav. That name, Shem Miuhad Lo Yitaleh. That name is unique to him. In what sense? We call that the Shem HaMeforash. We call that the explicit name of God. And you know, its idea is Shehu Moreh Al Atzmo Yitaleh. It's a name that we have that is our best attempt at expressing his being, not his action. Not what we experience from him, but what he is in terms of our capacity to talk about it. En safek yashem amromam hazeh, there's no doubt that this exalted name, asher en mavat'im oto, we don't even pronounce it. We will not speak it because we will not bring it down into the physical world by speaking it. We will meditate on it and call it something else when we see it. We look at it, we see it, and say Adonai. But we don't speak it. We see it. We understand what its meaning is in whatever capacity we can. We understand that we are talking about existence over here. The only ones who ever spoke this name were the Kohanim, when they blessed the people, the Birkat Kohanim, or the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. And that's it. Moren Yam Misuyam. He says towards the end, right, four lines from the bottom of the paragraph, in Shituf bin Hashem Itadeh bin Kol Mashizulato Beoto Anyan. God has, in the expression of this name, no comparison to anything. There's nothing like existence. You just can't. There's nothing like it. You can't compare anything that we know to that entity in any way. But that's what the name expresses. And then he says, very interestingly, Shemehu More, he says, perhaps it expresses, Kefi halashon she'en biyadenu hayom, according to an element of the language that we really don't have full competence with anymore today, meaning of this, the Hebrew language. V'gam kefi shemvatim oto, we're not sure how to pronounce it, al inyan chiyuv hametziut, on the idea of the necessity of being. Essentially saying, necessary being. That's what the name expresses. I can't even express to you how this turns everything on its head. It changes everything. But this is something that in some way, shape, or form, we need to teach children. So you know what we teach children? We teach them that God is one. But the Rambam says you also have to teach children that God has absolutely no body or limit of any kind, and let them run with that. And as they grow, they'll understand what it is that that means. They'll take God out of the box, but you have to take God out of the box for them. You may not allow a child to think that God has any body, limit, shape, form of any kind. That's his opinion. But what do you mean? I don't know. Work it out. Leave it. Because they will ask you when they're 4 and 5 years old, by the way. I cannot tell you. I'm a rabbi, what, I don't know, 25 years? Not 80 years. 25 years? Every year, without fail, somebody calls me and says, Rabbi, my son or daughter is asking me, where did God come from? And what is God? And why does he have a body? And so on. And I say, what is he, like 4 or 5 years old? Yes. That's when it happens. Right? Unless they're like really, really bright and thinking that's 3 years old. So that's in number two. K'shem she'tzarich lechanechet k'tanim. Ulfarsem Bahamun, ki Adonai tader drumem echad. Just as you have to teach children that Hashem is echad, that God is one. By the way, when we say Hashem, what's that? The name. What are we referring to? That name. Yud ke vav ke. And what it expresses.
People say Hashem all the time. Nobody really knows what they mean when they say it. Keep that, because it's going to be one of the last things that we read. I know I'm a little over time. Hold it. Hold your horses. We do not serve any other than him. We tell this to the children. You have to teach them that God has no body. And there's no comparison between him and anything else that's created. Plant that in the child's head. And they'll deal with it as they grow up. Take a look at number 6. Because I brought it up. And I'm going to end with this. People talk about Hashem all the time. Not a good thing to do, according to the Rambam. You got to be very careful when you're talking about God. He says, "Mi shechoshev b'Hashem," person who thinks about God, "umarbe lezochro bli yediyah," and talks about him all the time without knowing who they're or what they're talking about. They either go through some kind of thing that they've imagined when they say the word, or after something that somebody told them. But they don't really know what they mean when they say it. See, he makes very clear, he goes, according to my, in my opinion, he says, as far as I'm concerned, says the Rambah, not only is on the outskirts of the meaning of what everything is, rahog mimeno. He's not talking about God. He's talking about something else. He may be calling it God, but it's not God. Just because I use the word God for whatever it is that I'm talking about doesn't necessarily mean that I'm talking about God. I could be using that word and referring to something that has absolutely nothing to do with God. And so he says, look, they may be using the word and saying Hashem, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they know what they're saying when they use it, nor that they have any consciousness of it. They're not thinking about him. Whatever it is that they've got in their imagination, even that they are talking about their mouths, it doesn't fit with the existence that I'm talking about. It's whatever a figment of their imagination, whatever they've decided it to be. Like I mentioned earlier. So he says, "Ra'ui la'asok b'min zeh shel avodah ahar ha'akara sichlit." When we are talking about connecting to God, we need to know what it means. Who are we connecting to? What are we trying to connect to? When I realize that what I'm trying to connect to is existence, that I'm essentially trying to connect to life and being, changes everything. And therefore, anything that I do that cuts away at life and being doesn't bring me closer to God. It brings me further away from Him. And if I reject things that clearly have to do with the nature of the world and the nature of existential truths and realities, I'm rejecting not only an idea, I'm rejecting God. And so what the Rambam is saying is that we have to be careful to engage in everything that we possibly can to know about the nature of existence, if we are to know God, not just to know God, but to love Him. And so he writes, I know I said the last thing, but I'm finishing this, I'm closing this for you. He writes that if you take a look in number 5, Inohev HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ela Bedat Shedayehu, this he writes in the Mishneh Torah at the end of Ilchot Teshuvah, one cannot love God unless one knows God. Based on the level of knowledge, will be the level of love in direct ratio. If it's a little bit that a person knows God, they will only be able to love a little. But you say, I love a lot. Well, you're loving something else. But it's not God. If you love Him a lot, well, then you must know a great deal about Him. Lefichach, says the Rambam, therefore, tzaricha adam liyahed atzmo. One must aim oneself, put oneself aside, lehavin ulhaskil, to understand and to grasp, b'chochmot utvunot shmodeim lo et kono, on all of the wisdoms and understandings that are necessary to know his maker, to know the one that created him. Kifikoach shiyesh b'adam, to whatever capacity you can. Run to the limits of your capacity. How does one love God, says the Rambam. In number four, I'm not going to read the whole thing, just the opening line. He'achi ha'derech la'avato, how do you love God? V'irato, how do you find awe and reverence of God? B'sha'ashi yitbonen ha'adam b'ma'asav. Look at his works. Ubruav, and his creations. Haniflaim, that are wondrous. Hagedolim, that are great. V'ir'emhin, you'll see his wisdom. And how it is that they all function, and how they come into being, and how they are. En l'chayerech v'loketz. In the Hemeris, it has no end. That's how you love. So, we've come to the end, a little bit late, but you'll forgive me. If not tonight, tomorrow morning. When we talk about God, we are talking about primal existence. It affects everything you will ever learn. I cannot stress that enough. It affects everything you will ever learn. And all that you will ever do, if God is at all an element of your psyche in life. It changes Torah, it changes mitzvah, it changes everything that you know. He is primal being. He is the very force of existence itself. We are only because that is. And in some capacity, we, the Jewish people, believe that we entered into covenant with that entity and that we agreed to walk through the millennia of history hand in hand, so to speak, with that entity. Believe it or not, I'm not here to prove it to you. All I will say is, well, we're still here and we shouldn't be. Good night. Okay.